musical?
Yes.
I'm going to sleep.
Yes, sick kids at home, and now I'm on the edge.
So how did they bring the file out?
Not get worse.
Yep, let's go.
Okay, we have a quorum, so we're going to start the meeting, and we have a very tight schedule today. I'd like to get through the whole thing, so I'd appreciate it if you could, unless you have a very brief question on a particular point one of the speakers just talked about, that's fine. But if you have longer questions, save them until the next so we can get done. And so the first thing we're going to do is continuing care administration.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I'll move approval of the minutes from, can I do both? The January 15th and January 16th meetings.
Any discussion of that?
The one at night, I think it says I wasn't there, but I was there. Oh, no, I was there. Sorry, found my name.
Never mind.
Okay, any other? All those in favor of approving the 2 minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay, and then I think there was a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I noticed in the headlines yesterday, Health Partners and Park Nicollet are merging to become one unit. It's a major change in the healthcare industry. I just want to reiterate my comment from the previous evening. What we're seeing is, with the ACA, more and more of this consolidation due to lower expected reimbursement for the doctors and hospitals, coupled with what the ACA will do, will put additional layers of bureaucracy on an already heavily bureaucratic healthcare system. The result will be we're going to push more and more of our independent doctors out of business who are unwilling to make the investment on the technology side and unable to stay in business with the lower reimbursements. And ultimately, I believe this will lead to government-mandated rationing in the healthcare system as doctors get tired of seeing more and more patients at a faster rate. Now, Representative Liebling says the current system already has rationing, and I agree with her. But that rationing is done on a voluntary basis based on copay and deductibles. I'd much rather have a healthcare system where rationing is done on a voluntary basis by patients and their needs than on a government-mandated basis. I just put that forth for food for thought as we go forward on this.
Thank you. We have a very tight schedule today, so we'll turn it over to the speaker from the Department of Human Services. And if you would, Mr. Coleman, would you also state your name for the tape?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lauren Coleman. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care Services at the Department of Human Services. I'll be working from a document that is titled Overview Continuing Care Administration. You have a lot of papers in your packets, but that's what I'm going to work from to try to highlight what continuing care does and who we serve. Continuing care, and some people refer to it as long-term care or long-term care services and supports, is a range of services and supports that help people meet health or personal needs over a longer period of time. We are organized in four divisions. We have Aging and Adult Services, who is led by Gene Wood. We have Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services, which is led by Bruce Hodek. We have Disability Services, which the director is Alex Bartolik. And Nursing Facility Rates and Policy with Bob Held. As you can see from the document, we have a very large array of programs, approximately $3.6 billion annually in state and federal funds. And in one way or another, we touch around 350,000 Minnesotans annually. We administer the medical assistance programs for long-term care services, both waiver and state plan services. We provide information, education, assistance, advocacy, direct service. We manage nursing homes, ICFDDs, intermediate care facilities for developmental disability individuals, and day training and habilitation services. Much of our work is trying to assure service quality, conducting evaluations, and measuring results. Part of who we work with are the Minnesota Board on Aging, the Commission on Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans, and of course we have numerous stakeholder work groups. On the second page shows the distribution of medical assistance long-term care spending to give you a sense of the scope. About 74% of our dollars are now spent on what is known as home and community-based services, waivers, and home care. And about 26% of the funds are distributed to long-term care facilities, nursing facilities, and intermediate care facilities for developmental disabilities. Trying to be brief in the presentation, we also are demonstrating on the next page how funds are distributed in aggregate for our older Minnesotans and people with disabilities. The medical assistance spending, about 41% of the spending is dedicated to long-term care. And then again, a repeat on the distribution on long-term care spending on the bottom right side. And interrupt me at any time if I'm losing you in the paperwork. On the medical assistance for seniors, older Minnesotans, and people with disabilities, again, we have much of our funding that's distributed for home and community-based services. And the chart on what's my page 2 shows the distribution of that. It shows the DD waiver, the PCA program, the CADI waiver, and the other various programs that we use to support people in the community. On the institutional or facility side, it shows again the distribution between nursing facilities and DDs. You have a trend line in your packet, which is attempting to show the historical and projected spending in these programs. On the long-term care facilities trend line, what you will see is a fairly flat expenditure. And that's the result of an intentional long-range public policy to move services more to where people prefer them, which is in their home and in community-based settings. It is not intended to eliminate facility-based services, but it shows the market direction that is occurring. And that's not unique to Minnesota. It's happened nationally. So it gives you the five-year projection on that. And you will see that we serve fewer people in long-term care facilities. Their stays are shorter. They're there more for episodic care. And it doesn't mean that there are fewer people that may need a facility stay at some point in time, but they don't stay there typically as a residential service as they may have in past years. Concurrent with that, though, because of the way the system is moderating, we see some growth in the cost for those individuals. So on the bottom right-hand chart, you'll see that the cost per person will go up as the needs of the individuals in the long-term care facilities increase. On the next page, we've shown you both the dollar values as well as some historical perspective of what has taken place from 07 to 12. And again, it shows that pattern that the portion of the funding that is being utilized in the institutional sector has been declining and has been shifting more to the home and community-based side, which would be the next graph. The waivers and home care, and this includes both fee-for-service and managed care. A note that I would like to draw attention to is on the elderly waiver part of our program. We purchased that through the health plans. And so that's why that distinction is made here. So some of the waivers, we need to combine both the fee-for-service, the payments we make to providers directly, as well as the payments that we're providing to managed care entities. So you'll see the trend line for waivers and home care increasing. And that's where policy has directed Minnesota over the last 20, 25 years to provide services in the community. We see a growth continuing to project for the next 5 years of the number of persons served in the home community-based sector, the waivers and home care, from approximately 86,000 individuals currently to a little over 100,000 individuals by 2017.
Mr. Coleman, Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick, sorry to interrupt, but I just wonder, when you're showing us the trajectory of the cost, is that inflation-adjusted or that just today's dollars, assuming there's no inflation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is driven by the needs of the individuals. Unless there is a current law that distributes an inflationary increase, it would not be included in that.
And Mr. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, real quickly. You know, just on the on page two under long-term care, so the way I read this, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, is nursing homes will get higher reimbursement for their patients between 2013 and 2017. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the nursing home reimbursement is based upon an acuity model. So as the needs of the individuals increase, the higher the payment would be. So as we project mm-hmm. that the people living in nursing facilities would have higher needs, their payment would correspondingly go up. But the rates associated with each of those acuity measures would not necessarily go up.
Quick follow-up is, you know, and the problem really is in the rural area, is these nursing homes, you know, are losing money on every deal and making it up in volume. And they're looking at closing down in the near future if something doesn't change, where they can charge private pays at least a little bit more. Do you have any plans to recommend something like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of any plans to address the rate equalization law coming from the department at this time.
Thank you.
Continue, Mr. Coleman.
Okay, so on the waivers and home care, again, as I indicated, we will continue to see growth projected over the next number of years, as well as an increase in the cost per person for those programs. Let me then turn to the historical perspective on the waivers and home care, and again you'll see the chart that shows the increases projected but also the historical from 2007 to 2012 of what the state has been spending on these programs. I will also note that within the waivers and home care, it includes home care services and personal care assistance programs. So let me give you some scope, though, and you have it in your materials, but just to give you a sense of the waivers and the participants in those programs. We have the brain injury waiver, and that has approximately 1,350 individuals. We have the CAC, or the Community Alternative Waiver, which is basically an alternative to hospital-based level of care. It's our smallest of our waivers, has about 328 individuals. We have the CADI, the Community Alternative for Individuals with Disabilities, has about 16,500 people currently being served. We have the DD, or the Developmental Disability Waiver, has about 15,500. And then the Elderly Waiver has a little over 20,000 older Minnesotans included in that population currently between managed care and fee-for-service. So just to give you a sense of the scope of the programs. I'm going to turn now to some descriptions of grant programs. And we'll start with Aging and Adult Services grants. And these are specific grant opportunities that we work with counties, tribes, health plans, providers to serve the non-medical social services supports for older Minnesotans. We work closely and try to coordinate funds that we receive through the federal government through the Older Americans Act, which are primarily managed through the Minnesota Board on Aging. And so we try to coordinate that so we can be as efficient as and effective as possible. You have a list of some of the services that are managed through the grant process. Nutritional services are a significant piece of what we do, and you can see that congregate meals are being delivered to approximately 56,000 people annually. Home-delivered meals to about 13,000 older Minnesotans, and a grocery delivery service to about 600 people who otherwise would be at risk. We work on a significant amount of less complex services, but still very important to the older Minnesotan and their family. So you have a list of some of those through the chore services, transportation, some assistance with activities of daily living. Again, all intended to try to keep people where they prefer to live, which is in their own home. We try to use evidence-based health promotions as much as possible, and that body of knowledge is increasing every day as we learn what works better with older individuals and their families. When we're talking about older Minnesotans, we take a strong and comprehensive view of the informal supports, the informal caregiving that families, neighbors, friends are providing. We try to leverage volunteerism. We try to leverage, the informal supports as much as possible to help support the seniors in our communities. We also manage through this part of the department the senior linkage lines and trying to provide good information for which consumers can make informed decisions. Probably one of the more notable aspects of that is through the Medicare Part D enrollment. We publicize that. We have very experienced Medicare Part D counselors that can help people make the selection that best fits their needs. You can see from the document that we assist more than 67,000 people through this process, about 125,000 calls, and they're not short calls. They're usually complex questions that people need to understand. But we also are helping people through this linkage line service to explore their other needs, their housing needs, their service needs, connect them to the right agency, the right provider that best fits their needs. Let's see, what else I'm trying. Another important part of what we do is what we refer to as the Return to Community Initiative. And we work that through community living specialists through this program. And that is a very targeted program to help individuals who are residing in nursing facilities who have expressed an interest in returning to their home. Many, many older Minnesotans do so with the support of their families and their own initiative. There are some that need a little bit more support, a little need more planning, more guidance through a complex system to return home. So to date, I believe we have assisted over 600 individuals through this program, and we're also doing follow-up calls to make sure that once they have left the facility and they're living in their own home, that things are going well. And we're trying to follow those people over several years to not only make sure that it's successful, but that we learn from what has worked better and what has not worked as well that we need to improve.
Mr. Coleman, just a comment. I think this is one area that legislators really understand. If you've ever gone door knocking, and you knock on a door, and this little lady comes to the door, and you say, wow, I hope her son or daughter lives next door, or she's getting some kind of support, because we see a lot that we really are concerned about.
Not you.
All right. Again, in the interest of time, we'll move on to deaf and hard of hearing services. This is a part of the Continuing Care Administration that, again, is really targeting services and information to deaf, hard of hearing, deaf-blind individuals in Minnesota. We manage these services primarily through regional offices distributed throughout the state, and we have some very specific programs that have developed over the years that are very targeted to these individuals. Some of it is very informal. The individual or their family wants some information about services, and because of communication challenges, it's best to go to or contact these regional offices. We also have some very specific programs that we manage through this this service. We have a mental health program for individuals who have a mental illness who are also deaf, deaf-blind, hard of hearing, so that communication is not a barrier to be receiving good mental health services. We are responsible for the telephone equipment distribution program, which is funded through our telephone bills. And we help individuals who, again, who are deaf, hard of hearing, or deaf-blind to receive equipment that helps them remain independent and still be able to communicate and not be at risk. We recently received a small federal grant for deaf-blind individuals to distribute very specialized equipment to individuals who need that kind of support. We have a variety of somewhat smaller programs, but still very important to the individuals and their families who need these services, a mentoring program for families with children who are deaf or hard of hearing, so that we can match up those parents who are more experienced in dealing with the challenges of having a deaf child. Interpreter services, particularly in Greater Minnesota, evenings, weekends, some of those gaps that without these kinds of programs, people would not be able to receive the appropriate level of service.
Representative Norton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There may be this may be political and it may be historical, and I just am not clear. So I wondered if you could just let me know why we have a separate deaf and hard of hearing as opposed to just disabilities, and why isn't it rolled in together?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I don't have all of the historical background that existed when I arrived at the department. I will say this, that because it is because it resides within continuing care, we work very closely between the disability division and the deaf and hard of hearing division, and the lines are quite blurry in terms of how we approach services to people. But I think there are some very unique considerations for people who are deaf, deaf-blind, hard of hearing, that a targeted approach like this does work quite well. But I'm sorry, I don't know the historical, how did it, you know, initially get developed that way.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is about if I could get some further background information about the differences between services to Greater Minnesota and those over half the population that live in the metro area. Your summary makes reference to a variety of different services that are targeted towards Greater Minnesota, interpretive services, and I know your regional offices are disproportionately in Greater Minnesota, and I just feel like, you know, is that then the metro counties have to step up and fill the role, or do nonprofits? Is access in terms of affordability and response times and all those sorts of things equal if there's two different systems? I'd just like to have a better understanding of kind of the geographic spread, because I think, you know, in the past when we had the schools for those who are deaf in Faribault, you know, people tended to go to school there and settle in the rural areas. Now that's just not as common. With the Metro Deaf School, I mean, they're both important resources, but I'm just trying to make sure that, particularly with, you know, a growing aging population, which is oftentimes the hard of hearing, if not deaf, of the new people, so many of the young kids are getting cochlear implants and, you know, those sorts of things that are different alternatives that weren't there in the past. I'd just like to better understand, how does the service system work statewide, and is there equity of access?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to get you some information around that. Just a note, we do have a metro office right here in St. Paul, but we'll get you some information about how the resources and services are being delivered. Disability grants would be the next grant page that I'll reference. And again, much of the services that we provide to people with disabilities are through our through our waivers, our disability waivers, and home care. But again, there are some very important services that we manage through this grant process. I won't go through each one. They were all developed to, again, close a gap, minimize a gap, provide some options because people's circumstances are different. We have the Family Support Grant. We have the Consumer Support Grant. We have the SILS, the Semi-Independent Living Services, that, again, is intended to provide some of the lower-cost services that help people with disabilities live in the community. We have the HIV-AIDS Program, which, again, is targeted, and we work with our federal partners on serving people with HIV/AIDS, as well as the Department of Health. We have the Disability Linkage Line, which is similar, comparable to the Senior Linkage Line, but with a specialization in serving a younger population, the under 65 population, and helping them, again, navigate a complex system at times, and providing that one-to-one information and assistance. We have the Housing Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry to pause in this time, but I wanted to go just quickly back to the Senior Linkage Line, since you mentioned that there was some legislation last 2 years regarding that particular component. So I'm just curious, do we have the numbers as to, because it's a fairly new program, how much are saved, the state saved, by that linkage line and keeping seniors in their home longer than in assisted living or other facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do have some information about cost savings. Let me just slightly correct. The Senior Linkage Line is not new. It continues to evolve. It continues to build on what has been developed in Minnesota over the last 10, 12 years. The linkage lines are managed through the Area Agencies on Aging, so that we get the local component of making sure that those that are working within the Senior Linkage Line are familiar with local services. But we can get you some evaluation data to demonstrate the effectiveness of it.
That'd be fantastic. Thank you.
Representative Fritz.
That'll be great.
I would remind members that we're going to get out of here at 11:30, and if you look at the agenda, we've got a lot to go with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to add that the Senior Linkage Line, which has been around a long time, and actually now with those of us who are in the tsunami of aging, I often, when I get calls from constituents about some problems that perhaps we should be able to help them with, refer them to the Senior Linkage Line. So it's a good tool for us as representatives to use.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me draw your attention to the Housing Access Service at the bottom of the disability grant page. Again, this could be considered comparable to the return to community that I talked about earlier. The Housing Access Service, again, is a program to help people with disabilities who have expressed an interest in moving into their own home, who are currently residing in an institution or residing in a corporate foster care, adult foster care. And again, we've demonstrated success in moving. Actually, these numbers are a little outdated. Again, we have assisted more than 600 individuals with a disability to move into a home of their own, which has a win-win. It is oftentimes, if not always, less expensive than an institutional stay or a corporate foster care, and it enhances the quality of life and the choices that people have to have a home of their own. There are some other smaller but, again, important grants that are very targeted to individuals with disabilities. The Alternative Care Program, again, is a long-standing program. It is designed and intended to help people remain in their homes. There's a theme here. Help older Minnesotans remain in their home who are not yet eligible for medical assistance, but if we didn't provide this support, they would soon exhaust their resources and would have to go on to medical assistance and perhaps leave their home and move into an institution. It's, again, relative to our other programs, it's lower cost. It serves several thousand people annually. This is a state-funded-only program, but recently, and you'll hear more about the waivers that we have submitted to the federal government at another hearing, I suspect, Reform 2020 and so forth, where we have asked the federal government to participate in this program, that it is saving the federal government money. It's since it's saving the state money, keeping people off of medical assistance, off of that federal-state partnership, and we have made that request that, therefore, they should participate. They have not agreed with us yet. We're in the process of having those discussions. But we have included that in our submission to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Again, the average cost is quite low, but it is key to the individuals in this program remaining in their homes. That is the packet. I think you have some other information that's a little more detailed. And as we get into other specific topics in the coming weeks, I'm sure we'll be able to get into more specifics.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coleman. Any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Coleman, did you, I don't know if I missed this, did you mention how many people are in that last program that you mentioned?
The alternative care program, I'll have to look at my sheets here. 4,664 in state fiscal year 12.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. So it's not an enormous number of people, but because the cost of nursing home care is so great, that we're talking about significant dollars and savings if we keep people in their homes, I assume. And I just wanted to kind of, since it was brought up before, the whole issue of rate equalization, part of the reason that we want to keep that in place, right, is if those people do have any assets and they, well, maybe it's unrelated, I guess. But, you know, just to push back a little bit, when people go into a nursing home, if they have to pay more than people who are on the public programs, they're using up their assets that much faster and then ending up on the state's dime and the Fed's dime much quicker also. So I suppose there is a relationship there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the alternative care program, again, is a low-cost program, $700 to $800 a month. Compare that to the cost of an institutional stay. To qualify, you have to be within literally a certain number of months, if not days, that would put you at risk of exhausting your resources and having to move from your home. So we think it is very cost effective, and that's the argument that we're trying to advance with the federal government, that therefore it is saving both the state and the federal government money.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coleman. I think we're moving on to operations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'll be covering three separate business areas in the next half an hour to 40 minutes. I will cover first operations and then move on to the sex offender treatment program and then finish up with state-operated services. So you have a couple of pages that describe the operational or the infrastructure functions of the department. I think I can be pretty brief. We'll get into greater detail when we present and look at the budget. But there are really two parts to the operational support of the department. One are your traditional functions like financial management, human resources, management services, those things that provide support to the entire agency, compliance functions. But then there's another separate part of the agency that's included in the operational area, and that includes our licensing programs. And we really think of those as direct service. We license programs across the entire state, and we've also built a function of the Inspector General's office. I'll talk a little more about that in just a second. But so we really have two things in our operational programs, those that we think of more traditionally as supporting agency functions, and second, the licensing programs for the department. I also remind members, Mr. Chairman, members, that last year we finished the process. We didn't finish, but we completed one part of a transition of many of our staff moving to a consolidated minute, what used to be the Office of Enterprise Technology, which is now the state's enterprise technology department. We have moved well over 500 staff out of the Department of Human Services and into this consolidated area. Many, many are still located in our agency and work very closely with our business areas. We still show the cost for those programs in our budgets. You can see the budget information, where the funds come from. They come from a mix of general fund, healthcare access fund, but the biggest source of funding really is the special revenue fund and the systems fund. Licensing programs were put into the special revenue fund, I want to say about 3 years ago, starting about 3 or 4 years ago. We've slowly been moving, because they're supported by license and by fees, we've moved them into the special revenue fund and out of the general fund. And the systems fund is a fund that has been constructed inside of the agency to support the costs of technology. And there's a really a substantial federal match that goes along with technology investments in the state. The second half, or the back side of this sheet, actually lays out some of the different program areas. Because we have time limitations, you can take a look at some of the specific functions here. We have a compliance and legal office. We look for issues internally before others externally find them. We hopefully we are successful in correcting problems when we find them long before they are even more serious problems. I've already talked about information and technology support. The Office of Inspector General is new. It's new since the last budget presentations. It was created in this administration to really begin to tackle the issues of fraud, error, abuse in our programs, and working closely with the Attorney General's office, again, to when we find problems in our programs, we address them, and we address them aggressively.
Ms. Berry, does this group then do the... not fraud, but abuse of in adult foster care? There's been some very serious problems with some of those adult foster care people.
Mr. Chairman and members, the licensing part of the Office of Inspector General would address issues of maltreatment, abuse, neglect, and those issues. So they are all captured in the Office of Inspector General. So those. Traditionally, we've called that licensing, historically. They have now been combined with other activities around fraud and abuse to form the Office of Inspector General. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. We have the Chief Financial Operations Office. Here is where we have the basic financial infrastructure of the organization. Tens of billions of dollars move their way through and out of the agency, into the community, into individuals. We need a financing infrastructure to support that. We also have a group of people who provide reports and statistics and forecasts for these programs. A number of these programs are forecasted programs. They are entitlement programs by statute. So we forecast what we see as growth inside these programs and provide them to the Department of Management and Budget so they can be included in the statewide forecast. We also have a human resources function, management services. And finally, I'd like to talk about just two sentences. We have a place inside the agency where we focus on our relationships with partners outside of the department. One of those partners is clearly counties. We work very closely with counties in partnership in the delivery of human services programs. We work closely with tribes in the delivery of human services. And we've now created an Office of Community Relations where we hope to more closely work with those who are beneficiaries or recipients of services to get some feedback from the community about how we're doing. And one of the major focuses there is really how we address disparities in access and outcomes, particularly among populations of color across our state. So an emphasis, again, on partnership and how we relate with those partners is part of our operational functions. That is a big overview. I think you also have a budget summary, very high-level summary. Of the $350 million that is spent in operations, you can see that much of it, the bulk of it, is spent really on technology to support the operation of all of these programs. I don't know if there are questions.
It's a quick question. The Special Revenue System Fund that provides $240 million, where does that money come from?
So there are, Mr. Chairman and Representative, there are a couple of places where that comes from. One, it comes from the fees associated with licensing different types of providers. So for the in the license that goes with adult foster care, that goes with child care, that goes with any number of licensed programs. There's a fee associated with those. Those fees come back to the department. When we do background studies, those fees come back and go into the special revenue fund. The systems fund is really a creation of maybe, no, I don't know, maybe going back almost 20 years. Because there's a federal share on the cost of building technology and maintaining that technology, the legislature authorized the creation of this system fund. And so all that is appropriated really is the state share. And what comes back to the department is the federal share in addition to the state share. That makes up the system fund. It is to support technology.
Thank you. Representative Norton.
Thank you. And I just want to do a follow-up to the line of questioning that Representative Portman had, and that was with the special revenue fund. So if that's money, we often hear in testimony, we've heard recently, that we charge X for licensing and the rest of it goes into the, and we use this, you know, Y for our department, but our licensing brings in more than that, that it goes into the general fund. So help me understand the difference between when people tell us that at the table, which I've heard already in the last week, does it go into the general fund or does it go into the special funds? And if so, what if a board, say, of nursing or a board of one of the licenses wants to do a study? Do they then request money? Is it allocated to them? Because some licensing have very small fees that barely pay, and some have large fees, and a lot of money is not going back into their office, but it's coming in either to the general fund or special fund, depending on your answer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'm going to rely on some of my historical days working in what was the Department of Finance and now Management and Budget. There is a statewide special revenue fund, and all of the fees collected really are placed into the statewide special revenue fund and then allocated separately to boards and departments. So if there's a fee collected from a provider, it goes into the special revenue fund. There have been instances where MMB has recommended, and in the governor's budget and the legislature has adopted, places where some of that money from the special revenue fund has moved to the general fund. But as a rule, money doesn't move from a special revenue fund to a general fund without an act of the legislature. So special revenue funds are dedicated back to the program, are supposed to be dedicated back to the program where the license was collected. And those same license fees are used for things like maltreatment investigations and abuse and neglect allegations that need to be investigated. So the fee covers more than just an annual or biannual visit. It also covers the cost of maltreatment, neglect, and other allegations.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, that covered operations. Unless there are other questions, I would...
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair. I do have one quick question regarding, I noticed the area where you talk about investigating for fraud, human services. I would imagine there's some recovery of fees when that, or recovery of funds. What happens to those funds? Do they come back to the department or do they go into the general fund?
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the fees that we collect for fraud and abuse are non-dedicated receipts to the general fund. The department does not have the authority to keep those fees that we recover when we find fraud or abuse. And the same is true with the Attorney General's office. When they find fraud and abuse and it rises to the level of a crime, all of those funds are non-dedicated receipts back to the general fund. We don't have the authority to keep those fees or to keep those collections.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner, and you're going to keep going, I guess?
I'll keep moving. The next up is the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program. You should have a front-back document that covers this program. I don't think I need to tell you members that there is a spotlight that is certainly shining on this program. Just very quickly as a backdrop, the department had at least 65 separate actions by clients in our program that were brought against the department in federal district court. We are All of those cases have been consolidated into a class action suit. We have been working closely with the court to try to settle those issues that are within the authority of the department, but many of the claims or the corrections that are sought by clients in the program really require legislative activity. So, again, as we move forward and address issues, where we have authority, we have worked with the court and with the plaintiffs in this case. For example, the creation of the task force was one of the agreed upon settlement items between plaintiffs and the department. So we, the commissioner, appointed under the judge's order a task force. Some of you are members of that task force or are certainly aware of the activities of the task force and the recommendations of the task force. A second thing that we agreed to was an evaluation team that would come in. We already had an evaluation team that was looking at the program on an annual basis. We will now have a special evaluation team looking at clients who have been stuck in one phase of treatment for more than 36 months. So very specifically focusing in on those clients in our program who aren't moving through phases of treatment and what we can do to help foster that movement through treatment in the program. So again, just to highlight some of the other things and give some context to what we are doing inside the agency. While all of that is taking place, we are also clearly involved in running a program on two campuses, one in Moose Lake and one in St. Peter. The sex offender treatment program is comprised of clients who have been court-ordered to treatment to our programs, as I said, both in Moose Lake and generally, if somebody is committed to us, they go first to Moose Lake to begin the process of assessment for phases of treatment. At both the front and the end of treatment, clients come to us again through the court system. I think that's important to emphasize. We are responsible for treatment, but it's really the responsibility of the committing court for placement. And then at the end of confinement or at the end of treatment, it is again a court decision to make to move somebody into the community. Most of our clients, not all, but almost all of our clients, come to us from the Department of Corrections, where at the end of their criminal commitment or their criminal time, there is a review that is done, and once that review is completed, there is then a recommendation that's made to the county, who then would commit them to us for treatment or not. As I said, we are located in both Moose Lake and St. Peter, the big difference being those who are in Moose Lake are really at the early stages of treatment. Those who are at St. Peter have moved through at least one, if not two, phases of treatment and are in phase three or toward the end of treatment. We certainly could have our clinicians come and talk to you about those different phases of treatment I would assume there is much interest, but we could talk a lot about, I have one of our clinicians come and talk about those phases of treatment. But Moose Lake, early phases of treatment, St. Peter, and really end phases of treatment. Second page is about funding for services. You can see the growth in this population over time since 2008, where we had 483 people that were committed to us. By our projections, we still hold to these projections, by June 30th of 2015, we would almost have doubled that population to 820, not quite doubling, but 826 people would be committed to treatment in the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program. You can see that in 2014, for their coming biennial budget. This is not a forecasted program. This is not automatically incorporated into MMB's forecast. So the department would be required or will be required to show the cost of increased census or increased number of clients we're serving for 2014 and 15 in the budget. That will be coming to you in the governor's budget. But what we show here is the base year with a couple of asterisks, so you see that there is a cost associated with that growth. It's just not included in the forecast.
Ms. Berry, so we set the what we will pay for this program, and then you have to, whatever we set, you have to spend that money on, even though there's an increasing number of people, if we don't give you any more money, you have to treat an increasing number with no additional funds.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. This is a directly appropriated account, and we have to live within the appropriation.
Representative Liebler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Berry, I'm just looking at what you've given us here, and we see fiscal year 2012, we see a drop in the per diem, and then it goes back up. And I suppose that's probably related to what Representative Huntley just mentioned, but I wonder if you could just explain that a little bit and sort of tell us what you did to save that money.
So, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'll get the detail to support specific. I'm trying to determine if that's actually between a biennium, because there's the possibility that you know, at the end of the biennium, money sweeps out of the accounts, and then when you start the new biennium, you start at a lower base. So I will have to determine if, in fact, this has to do with the way we set the base in the department, or if it had to do with cost adjustments that were made in the program. It's probably a combination of both. Mr. Chairman and Representative, we also made some changes to the program. We added clinical staff while making some changes in the number of security staff. So this could be a combination of both, and I will follow up with you and with the entire committee to provide more detail about that change. It looks like a biennium to biennium change, and it might be impacted by the way we are instructed to do the base, because this is an appropriated program.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman. The task force that is currently meeting, is there, I wasn't aware of the timeline, when they will end and when they will present their findings to us. Are you aware of those? And that will be?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, there already are a set of recommendations. The task force was under a very tight timeline to release the first set of recommendations. They have been released, and they have to do with alternatives to placement into the sex offender treatment program. So it would provide some, with the appropriate legislative authority, it would provide committing courts with some ability to stay commitments, to look for our alternatives to treatment in Moose Lake. So those recommendations have already been released. The task force will continue to work through 2013, to the end of 2013, on a number of other items. So you can expect periodic reports. I can get the date of the next report when it's going to be released, but it will be during the legislative session.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm looking at the rising numbers and the lack of funding, perhaps, that you've experienced and may continue to experience. And it seems to me, and maybe this committee is dealing with this, that downstream, prior to coming to you, treatment might help eliminate the rise in numbers. Is there discussion going on about treatment prior to commitment that might reduce this number?
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, there is a lot of discussion taking place about services, treatment in the Department of Corrections, for example, before the end of confinement or before the end of that period of time before somebody transfers or is then committed, not transferred, but is committed to the sex offender treatment program. There's much discussion taking place there. There's also discussion taking place about alternatives, a secure community alternatives where treatment could take place long before commitment. The department will be releasing a request for information on January 22nd, which will seek community information about the number of secure settings available in the community. We'd like to get a head start on what options exist in the community for, as you've said, Representative Norton, looking for alternatives and alternative treatment sites that are not as expensive as the current program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, there was one other thing I didn't say, and I think it should be highlighted. In 2012, the first client out of the sex offender treatment program was provisionally discharged to the community and has moved once while in the community. And it's a pivotal point, really, a milestone for the program. And we expect that in the upcoming year there will be more Supreme Court appeal panel hearings, and that with the potential of other clients be recommended to move into the community.
And when they move into the community, is that like a group home or what is the...
Mr. Chairman, there are different kinds of arrangements. They look like group arrangements. They are residential group programs with different kinds, operating under different kinds of licenses, but the ones that I'm aware of are all group type, highly supervised group arrangements.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and not to take too much time with this, but I sort of feel like when the topic gets opened, I should say something, since I'm on the task force and Representative Abler is too, and I think he's stepped out, but since I'm here holding down the fort, you know, obviously the growth in cost is a big problem. A lot of this is not within the department's control. They pretty much have to take and deal with whoever they're given. And part of what we need to be doing, and there may be some legislation this session, partly based on what the task force comes up with, or, you know, we'll see where this is going. But the problem is, you can see all this money that's more and more is being spent on this program, and the real question is, are we getting the best public safety we can get for the money? Because we focus on a very tiny few people who are deemed dangerous, but in fact, right now, depending on where this person lives in the state, they may get committed or not committed. So we want to do some things around making sure that we have standards that are consistent, that we're very careful in using the best evidence we have about who really needs to be in this most secure and most expensive setting. Who can we deal with securely with full public safety in a less expensive and less restrictive setting? Because we have to remember, these are people who are not there under a sentence of conviction. So that's why, again, I think I said this yesterday in this committee or in the other committee, that these are patients. This is why it's under the Department of Human Services. It's not part of the Department of Corrections. So we have to be very, that's why the court is involved in this, because this is about, if we're going to hold them, and it's constitutional, they can only be held if they're being held for treatment. They have completed their punishment. So we're in this very difficult situation where we need to assure public safety, which is a huge, of course, huge interest to all of us. But we want to make sure that with limited public dollars that we're also getting the best public safety bang for the buck, and not risking having the federal court step in and tell us that they're going to take over our system and do something different, which could be very expensive for us. So we're going to try to balance these factors, and so this is what the task force is struggling with, and the department, and everybody's struggling with.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh,
I hope it's a very brief question.
Yeah, it's brief.
We're getting way behind.
Okay, sorry about that. Just a quick comment on this, and it's been an area of interest of mine when I served on public safety last year that came up. But, you know, I hope the committee is looking, and I'm sure they are, at what other states are doing. My understanding is other states are doing it for less on a per diem basis than what Minnesota is. Again, that's circumstantial comment, and, you know, hopefully the committee is looking at. Second thing is, I just, you know, when you take $320 a day times 365, you come up with over $119,000 a year, which is more than we spend on an Alzheimer's patient, who cannot toilet, dress, most of whom can't toilet, dress, or feed themselves, et cetera. So it just, you know, it seems like a very high amount for treatment that, in previous testimony at the Public Safety Committee, doesn't really cure them in the first place. And, so, and the last thing is, I hope the committee looks at options of limiting the access of violent pornography to our young people, which many experts believe is fueling this type of heinous and terrible behavior in our society. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman. I just wanted to comment on something Representative Liebling said, and I would 100% agree with you, and I'll compare it to this. What you said, that if the federal government steps in to take over our SOP program, it could be very expensive. I feel the same way with our exchange and the Obamacare. It could be and will be very expensive. Those comparisons are quite accurate, so I appreciate you bringing that to my attention, Representative Liebling.
Let's, members, if we can hold the questions till after all the presentations, it would certainly help. Commissioner Barry.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move on then to state operated services, which is another business area in the Minnesota Department of Human Services. just again for your information and context, the Office of the Legislative Auditor is nearing the completion of a program evaluation report. It is not their typical financial evaluation or audit. It is a program evaluation audit authorized by you in the last session to look very broadly at the operations of state-operated services. They are moving through that process. Of course, at this point, it's still confidential. They haven't released the report. But during the session, that report clearly will be released, and we'll have a lot of background information about state-operated services, and of course, will come with their recommendations that they make following the audit. Just simply as an overview, as I said, it's one of the business areas within the Minnesota Department of Human Services. It really consists of an array of both residential services and then treatment services. So it's a combination of both of those services. We are spread out with almost 200 different facility-based programs across the entire state of Minnesota. So the program reaches far and wide across the state. Our mission is really to partner with others so that people's basic needs are met, so that they live in dignity, and that they reach their highest potential. So we have people that we serve all along a continuum of care. We serve people with developmental disabilities. We serve people with mental health issues. We serve people with brain injuries, and we serve people who have chemical health issues. And sometimes we serve people who have a combination of those things. We are really working in our programs to provide, shall we say, a very broad range of services so that we meet people's needs wherever they are. We also have a responsibility in our treatment program to move people through treatment and back to the community. We do so because not only it's the right thing to do for people who can live in community to live in community, but also because there's a United States Supreme Court decision that requires states to move people into the most integrated environment. And we are doing everything we can in the agency to adhere to and comply with what is often referred to, and you will hear more about, the Olmstead decision. It's an older decision. It's about 15 years old. But really focuses us to think about how can people live in the most integrated environment, and what can we do to, as a community, to support that. Very quickly, who we serve is at the bottom half of this page. We have a number of community-based hospitals. They are located, again, across the state. I should also point out that we are financed two ways. There are either direct appropriations from the legislature, from you, or we are given authority to create an enterprise fund where we collect the fees and they go back into running the programs. So when I run through these programs that are on the bottom of the page, I'll try to separate them for you. Generally, if there's fees associated with the program, they're in the enterprise fund. That's a rule, but it is occasionally broken. So, the first would be an example. We have 16-bed community-based hospitals. Because they are 16-bed or less, they are eligible for medical assistance. Most of these are certified and licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health through the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. So, therefore, they are eligible for payment, but they are not in the enterprise fund. They are directly appropriated. I think the history on that is we didn't know if we were going to get a federal match on these programs, and until we did, they shouldn't be in an enterprise fund. Right now, the fees we collect are non-dedicated receipts back to the general fund. So there are fees to cover these programs, but they are directly appropriated by you. The Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center is an inpatient psychiatric hospital. It is for adults. It is one of our remaining campus-based programs. It's still a large institutional treatment program. It is directly appropriated by the legislature. We serve mainly people who have mental health issues, but there are some people who may come to us who also have chemical health issues and potentially brain injuries as well. We also have the Minnesota Security Hospital. It is located in St. Peter. There we do specialized forensic services. People who are there are committed to us by the court as mentally ill and dangerous, or they have been committed because they need competency restoration before standing trial. So the Security Hospital, St. Peter, is another one of our campus-based programs, Anoka and St. Peter being the two campus-based programs that remain. It is a directly appropriated program. Community support services are directly appropriated.
Commissioner, let me interrupt there. The one I drive by the one, what used to be the one in Brainerd, and it's been completely torn up this summer. And we also had the one in out west central part of it, which has been turned over to the county, I think.
So, Mr. Chairman, there are two facilities that still have some programs on them. Brainerd is an example. We still run a program that specializes in serving people who have had traumatic brain injuries. It is a small program. It's less than 16 beds. It's a specialty service. And then we also have a Minnesota Care operation that has nothing to do with state-operated services on the Brainerd campus. So we process forms, eligibility for people who are applying for Minnesota Care out of an office on the Brainerd campus. We also have still some remaining presence on the Wilmer campus. I think that's the one you're referring to. We have a community behavioral program for adolescents. It's referred to as CABS. So it's a adolescent behavioral health service program. Again, very specialized on young adults, teenagers and young adults. And that is located on the Wilmer campus. And then we also have some programs that are scattered around the Wilmer area. We have a community-based hospital there. And I think we have an intensive rehabilitation treatment service there as well. But as far as large campus programs, the two that remain really are Anoka and St. Peter.
Was it the Wilmer one that was in the Minneapolis newspaper? I mean, you don't own that building anymore.
Fergus Falls.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, it was Fergus Falls. And Fergus Falls is no longer owned by the department. It is owned by, I believe it's owned by the county.
That's a very interesting building, just architecturally. And I think it could take a direct hit from atomic bomb. That move of
Mr. Chairman, Tom Reuter has also reminded me that we have a chemical dependency program on the Wilmer campus. So we run one of our care, what we refer to them as the care program, their chemical dependency programs, and they also sometimes treat people who have co-occurring conditions of both chemical dependency and mental health issues. So that is still on the campus as well as a community-based adolescent behavioral health program. We also run community-based dental clinics. I would say historically, the campus-based programs had medical services and dental services right on campus. When I worked at Rochester State Hospital many, many years ago, all of our medical services and dental services were right on campus. Well, over time, as people moved into the community, we really needed to provide a way for our clients or the clients living in the community to get those services in the community. These dental clinics really do specialize in people who are developmentally disabled. They do also serve some clients who are mentally ill and chemically dependent. 2 years ago, I believe, we received legislative authority to seek federal approval for payment of these services, and I believe we are either near or close to receiving that federal approval so that we would get, these are all clients who are eligible for medical assistance and should, their services in the community should be covered by the medical assistance program. There shouldn't be a direct appropriation for this program, but I don't think we're to the point of having this be completely fee recovered. But there, the potential clearly exists. I miss community support services. This is where we agreed to provide more services to people in the community so we prevent institutional placements. We want to do everything we can upstream so that if people don't need to be placed in an institutional environment, we do what we can to support them in their homes, in their communities, so that they do not come to us. We also have chemical dependency inpatient treatment and outpatient treatment programs around the state. And finally, we have a number of community-based programs. They are small, either licensed as intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities or as foster homes where we serve people who are developmentally disabled in the community, and then also provide day programming, sometimes vocational programming for those clients as well. So you can see it's quite expansive set of services spread throughout the entire state, as I said, in almost 200 facilities across the state. We employ about 3,500 full-time employees. And you can see that the base appropriation for the department is about $370 million and a direct appropriation. We also receive some funding through mental health and chemical health services because we receive the rates that they pay for those services. You can see then the last chart really is just a distribution of all of those funds across the programs. A lot to cover, but if there are questions, I would certainly be willing to stand for them, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Yeah. Oh, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner, or Mr. Chairman, and Deputy Commissioner Barry. If you could give us some further breakdown on the revenues, the fee-based revenues, how much is from private insurance, how much is from other public sources, that sort of thing, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, we can do that.
Representative Leibwick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Barry, as you were going through this, you were telling us which ones were direct appropriation and which ones were enterprise. And I think you sort of stopped doing that partway through. And I'm kind of, at least I didn't get it in my notes here, and I was kind of tracking it. So community support services, I don't know if you really said much about that. Is that a appropriation or is that a...
Mr. Chairman and Representative, you're right. The last three I didn't designate the same way I had before. So community support services is a directly appropriated account. The community-based dental clinics, we have the authority to receive the federal appropriation that would be associated with coverage of that service, but they right now are directly appropriated accounts. The chemical dependency inpatient and outpatient services are part of the enterprise accounts, so they live on the fees that they receive from either from medical assistance or under the chemical dependency treatment fund or for private payers in some cases. And community-based services, the residential and vocational services, are part of the enterprise account. Sorry for
every state. Okay, well, thank you, Deputy Commissioner, and we'll move on to chemical and mental health.
First three.
I'll do it for me.
Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representatives. I'm Dave Hartford, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Administration. And in respect to your time frame this morning, I'll give a brief overview of the administration. In your packet, you'll find a two-page handout with a couple color graphs on it with our financials. So the Chemical and Mental Health Administration comprises the State Mental Health Authority and also the Substance Abuse Authority. It is made up of three distinct divisions, the Adult Mental Health Division, the Children's Mental Health Division, and the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. All of these, in common, develop the policy and standards development. They also provide technical assistance, consultation, and training. But they are also unique. If you look across the three divisions, they all have very specific technical expertise. They work with specific stakeholder groups, and they also work in very specific service delivery system or separate service delivery systems. And I point this out because SAMHSA recently, that's the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, has begun to use the term behavioral services, and I think this is important because there continues to be an effort nationally and locally to improve the integration of substance abuse services and mental health services where appropriate. And this is important. There's more and more conversation as we talk about healthcare reform and the ACA. What does that mean as we look at chemical and mental health services, especially now we're starting to talk about integrating with primary care, and what does it look like as it integrates again with the rest of healthcare. So it's just, I think, an important concept moving forward. And inside the work of the administration continues to work both in the specifics of the specific areas that require the special expertise and particular delivery system, but also with the where they can work together in common to become a more integrated system. The administrative funding for chemical and mental health is $8.5 million. We employ 87 people, and their salaries are funded both by state appropriation and federal grant funds. The Adult Mental Health Division, along with Children's Mental Health Division, constitute the State Mental Health Authority. As such, they work closely with the local mental health authorities, the counties. We also work closely with the 16 mental health initiatives and the 11 tribal authorities. Also, stakeholders to this to these services are private providers, consumers, families, advocates, and other state agencies and funders. We work to shape, develop, and evaluate policy, service delivery, financing, in an effort to support a person-centered, recovery-based delivery system. The publicly funded system in Minnesota serves 116,000 people annually through a variety of different services, such as intensive residential services, assertive community teams, crisis services. The division works to coordinate the development of statewide and local mental health system planning, including goals and objectives. Currently, our Mental Health Reform 2020 activities going on, multiple stakeholder groups across a number of different service categories are doing planning, again, as it relates to how do we need to upgrade or update our system so it better meets needs and we integrate with the changes that we anticipate coming forward or the other opportunities that are taking place in the healthcare landscape. We develop new programs and services consistent with research-informed and evidence-based best practices. Minnesota continues to be a national leader in the implementation of evidence-based practice. Just this last year, we implemented a certification process for integrated dual diagnosis treatment, first certification of its kind in the country. We allocate and monitor, this is in the adult mental health area, funding of $150 million of state-appropriated grant funds, and we also allocate and monitor federal mental health grants. The Children's Mental Health Division is committed to promoting and supporting the mental health development of all children and youth. The division is responsible for developing and sustaining a community infrastructure of developmentally appropriate services. And I wanted to point that out. I think that's an important concept, is developmentally appropriate. Unlike if you look at the adult system, many of the services serve people, let's say, 18 to 55, and that's easy enough to conceptualize. But when we look at children, we have preschool, we've got grade school, school age, we've got high school, and each one of those, in order to have appropriate service delivery system, really needs to match those ages. So that developmentally appropriate, and how do you get services, the arrays of services necessary to meet the needs of those children? Our vision is
just for the members, your members. This is the privacy issue with this group of people is a very serious concern, and I'm not a big supporter of anti-privacy stuff. But this is an area that that I really believe that we need to be very careful about the privacy. I mean, if you have a kid that's determined to be have a mental illness, and he's going to school. Normally, if a kid has asthma, they go to school, and the asthma is looked at by the school nurse all day long. But if you want to do that with mental illness,
our vision is that these services will be fully informed by research as possible, and will lead to measurable reduction in mental health symptoms and increases in functional abilities. Children who have had challenges during their development will approach enter adulthood as resilient, competent youth. An estimated 91,000 children in Minnesota need treatment for emotional disturbances. The numbers are 9% of school-age children and 5% of preschool children have a serious emotional disturbance. We know that early identification and intervention produce better lifelong outcomes for children. That's why the division's priorities are early identification and intervention, early access to statewide services, and effective services. Currently, approximately 43,000 Minnesota children annually receive publicly funded mental health services. The division has historically played several key roles in the state's mental health delivery system. One, to monitor and provide technical assistance to county human service agencies in their role as mental health authorities. Also, we administer and monitor $35 million of state-appropriated grants. We support 95 local family service and children mental health collaboratives as vehicles for integration across our child-serving systems. And we also collect and analyze data to determine both individual and system outcomes, such as the psychotropic medication monitoring system that just recently was implemented. We're just gathering data. That's a program that assures that children receive appropriate medication dosing for psychotropic medication. Next, a few words about the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. In 1973, legislation was enacted that designated the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division as the single state authority on alcohol and drug abuse. The statute really establishes our mandates and responsibilities for the division, with an overall goal to reduce alcohol drug use as well as the resulting social and economic costs. And I wanted to point out, Commissioner Jessen, in partnership with 9 other state agencies this last year, developed a statewide substance abuse strategy. It's really the first of its kind in the country where 10 agencies, state agencies, came together to create a framework looking forward, recognizing the complexity of these issues and the need for really multi-agency coordinated efforts in order to address some of them. Certainly at the top of the list right now is the prescription drug issues, and again, that's multiple state agencies involved in that. So the framework has been developed, and we're a few months into the planning of putting together action plans around issues.
And that would include methadone, I understand.
That's part of that priority. Mr. Chair, the division provides policy and funding for substance abuse treatment through the development and implementation monitoring of addiction treatment services for public patients in Minnesota. The Consolidated Chemical Dependency Fund is the primary funding mechanism for these services. There is the second pie chart, and often the Consolidated Fund is a confusing piece of funding. It's a designated fund for chemical dependency treatment. The second pie chart shows what funding the state base forecast for the biennium is $273 million, which is funded by 160 of state appropriation, and the remaining 112 by a combination of federal and county. And the pie chart gives you those breakdowns. Other state funding administered by the.
We have another question from Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for you regarding the alcohol dependency. Do you have numbers that indicate each year, each decade of those who are still dependent on alcohol, or some of the success rates of since it was enacted in 1973 to deal with alcohol dependency and drug addiction? Do you have data that shows us the numbers of those who are addicted or who have gotten off the dependency of alcohol? And then in correlation with that, can those numbers be compared with perhaps an AA treatment center, which is, I think, is I believe a private, privately funded. So, those numbers or those information available to us?
I can certainly, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, there's certainly been a lot of work done over the years in trying to quantify some of the questions that you have there. We have our own, what's referred to as DANES data in Minnesota. It's more around completion rates. Minnesota has not funded a large comprehensive study. Nationally, there's been a number of different studies that are really getting it to the cost, societal cost, what's the value of treatment versus non-treated in terms of healthcare costs, or more broadly costs. I can certainly supply you with different pieces of data, but like I say, Minnesota has not funded a comprehensive study of the kind that you're referring to.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative McDonald.
If I may, thank you. So we have a population in Minnesota around, what is it, 5.3, thank you, I get that mixed up, 5.3 million. So we don't know how many are addicted or on alcohol or drugs.
I think nationally the data, there are estimates you would run about 10% of the population with some kind of substance use issues. I mean, those are kind of numbers that are broadly given or estimates. So it's large number, we're talking about large number of people with that abuse substance.
And then lastly, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would presume that since we fund this very important program for our citizens, in helping them get off their addictions. I would guess that those numbers are very important. We should have those at the tip of our tongue just as equally as the money that we know that we put into the program. Those should be, it's for those experts that are presenting the information, that should be just right there. I can't imagine that we don't have any data that shows us the success or the failures of the program. I'm just surprised, to be honest. If you told the rest of the Minnesota, this is what we spend on this program, and we don't even know how many are in it, or if it's working, or the success rates and failures, I just can't imagine that we don't have that data, you know, for those experts at the tip of your tongue.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, we certainly have a great deal of data we could supply around completion rates and all of that information. One of the challenges in this is not everyone abusing substance is the same as the next person. We have some people, so you have large numbers of people who may use in one fashion. You have others that are really quite chronic in their disease. So the outcome data, and there are a great deal of studies, like I said, that we could quote and supply you with that data around outcome data for different kinds of programs with different populations. It gets more specific. It's hard to speak in generalities about success when somebody that may be going to a AA meeting, their disease may be at a very different point than someone else. So it's hard to get an apples to apples unless you actually drill down the data. And like I said, we'd be glad to supply you with more information. Okay. Likewise, in the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, we also administer other funding for two targeted grants for underserved population, $2.6 million. The division is also responsible for the allocation and monitoring of substance abuse federal block grant funds. The block grant funds are really designated for populations experiencing health disparities, and just they are around. These are competitive grants provided to many providers and agencies around chronic chemically dependent and homeless people involved with criminal justice, American Indian Continuing Care Services, co-occurring services, substance abuse screening, evaluation, and treatment with primary care. The Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division manages over 130 contracts and grants. And now I'll refer to the pie charts as the first one being the summary of chemical and mental health services state base appropriation. Now just quickly go around administrative operations, $8.5 million. The adult mental health grants of $150 million, that is primarily goes to the Adult Mental Health Integrated Fund. Those are funds that are distributed to counties and to primarily and our mental health initiatives. Children's mental health grants of $35 million. Many small grants. A couple of the primary ones are mental health screening and school link grants. Chemical dependency non-entitlement grants. These are two target populations. And lastly, the chemical dependency entitlement grants, the state share of $160 million. Next, I already covered or touched bases on the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund cost projections. Again, this is a forecasted program, and you can see the breakdown there of the state, two blocks from the federal government, and the other piece paid by counties. And then lastly, I included, for your information, is the statutory federal funds, ones that have already been allocated to us, the mental health federal block grant of $21 million, that is really added to our mental health block grant. The mental health federal grants other, the primary recipient of that is PATH program, which is mental health and homelessness. Again, chemical dependency block grant, $42 million from federal dollars. And lastly, chemical dependency federal grants other, and that is primarily prevention dollars that we get from the federal government.
Any questions? I have one. How do you integrate with the Department of Corrections when people are being released because 60-70% of the people in prison have mental illness or chemical dependency? And how do you integrate with them to treat these people when they're released? You don't treat them while they're in prison. That, I mean, somebody does, but you don't.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a good response for you because I do not believe, to my knowledge, there's not a great integrating piece there. I think that there's a lot of improvements that could be made in that arena in transitioning to treatment programs in the community, and others could step up with that. And I'll carry forward your question, but I think we have some improvement we could make there.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask a similar question on how do you relate to the Department of Education on early screening of children for mental health?
That link, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, there are linkages. Our department does work with the Department of Education. I mean, a large piece, schooling grants. I mean, we have different grant programs that are working with within the schools today, so we do have those linkages.
Well, I don't see any other questions, so thank you very much for your testimony. And next, we're going to have Children and Family Services.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ralph McWhorter with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and our Assistant Commissioner Aaron Sullivan Sutton bit the dust about dinner time last night with the flu. So she's still alive, but it was a little came on strong. So if you'll bear with me, I'm not as knowledgeable, but I'm a little taller. We'll see if that helps with this presentation. You should have in front of you is the packet for the Children and Family Services Administration, and hopefully you have already seen a forecast page that George Hoffman talked about. So I'll start just general comments first, and to say that the Children and Family Services Administration is responsible for services to promote better outcomes for some of Minnesota's most vulnerable children and adults, and our services are targeted toward at-risk children and adults in adverse conditions due to abuse, neglect, extreme poverty, disability, and those at risk of becoming dependent on the public programs and services that are more deep end and costly. The research has demonstrated that investing in early childhood care and development, preventing child abuse and neglect, and assisting people in meeting their basic human needs are fundamental in ensuring health and productive citizens. We balance the needs to reduce expenditures and to align the limited resources with those services that have been proven to be effective in improving outcomes in the lives of people served and reducing the downward trajectory that otherwise would occur. And you hear that a lot, and we're part of that group of people who work on those programs. In the 15 minutes, I can't describe all of our efforts. Our handout provides information in more detail on our programs and persons served, and here are some of the highlights. So in the packet at the bottom, you'll kind of hear me start a little bit on there. So Children and Family Services works with the counties, the tribes, and community organizations to help low-income families and children achieve economic stability. And we do that through programs called the Minnesota Investment Program, the Diversionary Work Program, Child Support Enforcement, Child Care Assistance, Food Support, Refugee Cash Assistance, and Employment Services. And we provide assistance to individuals through the General Assistance, Minnesota Supplemental Assistance, and Group Residential Housing Programs. It's a lot of ways that we try to provide supports to people who have difficulties. We also focus on child welfare, and we work with counties and tribes to ensure children at risk of abuse and neglect and their families receive services that they need quickly and close to home. And we guide the policy through your public policy on child protective services, out-of-home care, and permanency, including the adoption of children whose parental rights have been terminated. So getting to the financial aspects, our Children and Family Services Administration is about 11 to 12% of the entire department budget. We have about 64% of all the direct appropriated non-forecasted grants. So there's other kind of wraparound services. And we have about 9% of the forecasted programs, and you'll see those on slides 3 and 4. Our programs are the ones that are bolded and on that page. We also want to emphasize on the next page of handouts is that we have four major federal block grants that operate in Minnesota. And those include the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families grant of about $263 million. Many people refer to this as the TANF grant. These provide funds to meet the needs of low-income families, providing assistance to those families, ending dependence by promoting job preparation, work and marriage, and focusing on reducing the incidence of out-of-wedlock pregnancies and the formation and maintenance of two-parent families. The federal maintenance of efforts is required for this program, and we're required to supply at least $176 million to $188 million per year as a match to the federal program. The number depends on whether we're meeting the current federal work participation rate for our state. Moving on, the Child Care Development Fund is about $82 million a year, and it supports low-income working families through the child care financial assistance and promotes children's learning by improving quality of early care and education and after-school programs. The purpose is to increase the availability, the affordability, and the quality of those child care services. We do have a federal matching maintenance of effort requirement of about $48 million in order to draw the maximum federal funding available for that program. At the bottom of your handout there on that page, you'll have the Social Services Block Grant is about $29 million a year. This is a broad-based federal social services block grant to meet the needs of individuals that must be directed toward five major goals that focus on preventing, reducing, or eliminating dependency and preventing or remedying neglect, abuse, or exploitation of children and adults unable to protect their own interests. Those funds we move on to the counties to provide that service. There are no federal match maintenance of effort requirements for that program. And in Minnesota, in a broad context, social services are basically supported primarily by local county property taxes, state aids, and other grants such as the Social Services Block Grant. The fourth block grant that we have from the federal government is the Community Services Block Grant of about $8 million a year. And those are grants that go to the community action programs to provide the basic infrastructure necessary to support low-income families and individuals to attain skills and knowledge and the motivation to become self-reliant. There are no federal matching requirements for that program as well. So moving on to the next page of the handout, in regards to forecasted programs that you'll be dealing with this session, George Hoffman has already provided information regarding our Children and Family Services Administration's forecasted programs, and it was the last page, I believe, of his handout, and you'll see that showing the cash assistance for the MFIP, Minnesota Family Investment Program, General Assistance, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, and the Group Residential Housing. He's already provided the details and the trending of that. We also have on slide 7 of our handout the description of other programs that we have that include the MFIP, the Virginary, actually I'm repeating myself here, the Cash and Food Assistance Grants. We have the Minnesota Family Investment Program Transition Year Child Care Assistance Grants that provide financial subsidies to help low-income families. We have the Minnesota Supplemental Aid and the General Assistance. Minnesota Supplemental Aid is actually the state's monthly cash program for people who receive the supplemental security income from the Social Security Administration. It serves as our maintenance of effort to the federal program. And our General Assistance Program is the primary safety net for single adults, provides about $203 a month in cash assistance. And people who are eligible for that program then become eligible for our Supplemental Nutrition Program and our Medical Assistance Program. Moving on, the Group Residential Housing Program is an income supplement program for persons who are on general assistance or Social Security benefits, and it pays the room and board costs in a variety of settings, including private market rate housing, assisted living, adult foster care, and board and lodges. I'm moving quickly here, but I'm going to move in now into the non-forecasted items that are on the next page, starting with slide 9. The most notable of these are things such as the support services grants, which provide employment, education, transportation, training, and other supports, kind of a wraparound to the TANF program activities that we have to help low-income families. And we have the basic sliding fee child care assistance grants, which provide financial subsidies to help low-income families pay for child care so that parents may pursue employment and so that children are well cared for and ready to learn. We have the Children's Services Grants, which fund a continuum of the statewide child welfare services for children who are at risk of abuse and neglect, have been abused or neglected, are in out-of-home placements, or in need of adoption, and there are a number of areas in which we provide supports and services and direct the work of the counties and the tribes in that effort. We also have the Children and Community Services Grants, which now actually are known as the Vulnerable Children and Adult Act grants. A couple of years ago, the legislature took action to target those grants as we reduce the value of those grants. They support serving children that are vulnerable or adults that are vulnerable, and those grant funds go through the county system. The Children and Economic Support Grants provide funding for housing, food, and other services for low-income families and individuals in transition. And you'll notice that the major portion of that are federal funds through the Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program. Starting on page 12 of the handout, you'll see more programmatic details, benefit levels, statistics about the programs administered by the Children and Family Services Administration here at the Department of Human Services. And bottom line is this presentation is much too brief for the time we have, and we look forward to the discussions in the future during this session to talk about these important efforts and the role that these supports provide to meeting the unique needs of Minnesotans. Thank you.
This is an area that where the counties do a huge amount of work, and also it's very good. So are there any questions? Don't say any thank you, Mr. Porter.
Thank you.
And next, we have health care.
Yeah, 10 minutes is plenty for this. I don't know.
Do it in
talk
time.
Fast.
Commissioner Lights.
I'm fine with me.
I want to tell you the other night when you gave that presentation, it was fantastic. One of the best presentations. I had since my identity. So I'm putting a lot of weight on your shoulders right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just take a few seconds to thank staff who actually were the ones who pulled it together. I was just the deliverer of it. So I appreciate the compliment. May I ask, Mr. Chair, how long you would like? We can do as little or as much as you need.
9 minutes. Well, we can. You know, we're scheduled to go to 12, which is 10 minutes, and we could probably run a little bit over that.
Okay, I'll be very brief then, Mr. Chair. I'm Scott Lights, the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at DHS. The Healthcare Administration administers essentially the state's public healthcare programs, which involves all aspects of eligibility, purchasing, provider enrollment, claims processing, and then measuring how well we're doing. I'll very briefly just describe, we operate the medical assistance program, which enrolls about 768,000 individuals, as well as the Minnesota Care program, which is for individuals who have incomes above Medicaid levels but do not have job-based coverage. We enroll about 127,000 people in that program. The Medicaid program, both Medicaid and program and Minnesota Care program, are programs which have federal financial participation, which means we pay half of the cost of the program. The federal government pays half of the cost of the program. Largely, these programs operate under broad federal requirements with the ability for states to tailor programs to meet their local needs. For example, we have certain benefits which are required under Medicaid, but certain benefits which are optional under Medicaid, as an example of how that works. And we set the payment rates within Minnesota underneath the broad federal requirements. I'll skip to a slide. I don't know if these are numbered. Slide number 9, I believe, which simply shows the breakdown of enrollment and cost for our Medicaid program. We, as I mentioned before, this is broken down between families and children, elderly and disabled, and adults without children. We enroll about 768,000 people in the program, but what you can see is that more than half of those enrollees are families with children. The cost per capita of those families, however, is the lowest. It's about a third of the cost of the elderly and disabled, which is about $12,000 per person. The message here that I'd just like to leave is that while our programs, while the majority of our program enrollment is actually families and kids, the majority of our program spending is actually done on elderly and disabled individuals, and that's because of the health needs that they have. They're, by definition, folks who are either disabled or elderly with high health needs, and so that's where the majority of the actual spending within the medical assistance program is. For state fiscal year 14, we estimate about $5.7 billion in spending on the Medicaid program. On slide 11 is just a chart of program growth over the course of the last decade. And you'll see that this is for elderly and disabled. You have a little bit of a jump up in 2014, and that's primarily due to largely from the effect of the requirement that individuals have health insurance coverage starting in 2014. And so we anticipate, George Hoffman has estimated, that we'll have additional people coming on to the program. Similarly, on slide 12 for families and children, families with children, our basic care program, you see a similar type of a trend line where it is an increase starting in 2014 because of that insurance requirement that is in place at that point. As I mentioned before, on slide 13, description of the Minnesota Care program. Again, this is a program that we operate with federal financial participation. It was put in place 20 years ago in 1992 to cover people who had incomes higher than what Medicaid eligibility was, but did not have job-based coverage. So we enroll a lot of people who are, for example, farmers or sole proprietors operate through, get their health insurance coverage through the Minnesota Care program. The major distinction between these two programs, the benefits are actually roughly similar, especially for children. People on Minnesota Care pay a premium, however, whereas people on Medicaid do not. And for certain individuals, particularly single adult populations on Minnesota Care, there's a $10,000 cap that's placed on their hospitalization care. So we pay up to $10,000, but not beyond that. On slide 15, Minnesota Care is funded through a variety of sources. The major source of funding for Minnesota Care is the Healthcare Access Fund. This is funded by a 2% tax on providers, on their gross revenues, all health providers, and a 1% tax which is placed on nonprofit HMOs and nonprofit health services corporations in the state. But enrollee premiums as well help pay for the program, as well as the federal financial participation. Eligibility for Minnesota Care goes up to 275% for kids and parents, and up to 200% for adults. The next slide, which is slide 16, breaks down enrollment and cost for the program. Again, we enroll about 127,000 Minnesotans in Minnesota Care. They receive benefits which are roughly equivalent to what they would have otherwise received in the Medicaid program. We spend about $675 million on the program on an annual basis, or that's the estimate anyway for fiscal year 2014. Let me just mention on slide 17, is again a decade look at us expending on the program. You'll see that there was a dip in fiscal year 2012, and that was really came about as a result of the early MA expansion that occurred. Many of you know that in Minnesota we were one of the states that took advantage of the opportunity that the Affordable Care Act provided to expand our Medicaid program in advance of 2014 at current match rates. And so for folks below 75% of poverty, we moved them from the Minnesota Care program where they were paying premium, or actually we moved them from the Minnesota Care program into Medicaid, and so you had a decline in the number of folks in Minnesota Care. That was actually also the population that had formerly been covered under the old General Assistance Medical Care program.
The General Assistance Medical Care program was 100% state dollars.
Mr. Chair, correct. I have in my minute remaining, Mr. Chair, I'll just mention a couple of very brief things. One is that I think in the healthcare administration, our primary goal, in addition to working to increase and expand and streamline our eligibility so that people can get into the coverage that they're eligible for, we've really focused a lot of our efforts in our first 2 years on purchasing reforms. And we've done that in a couple of ways. One, we've focused on improving the way that we do our contracting with managed care organizations. In 2011, did a competitive bid process for contracts in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. That was a fairly successful process that allowed us to reduce spending in the program by over $150 million. But we also negotiated some profit caps, as well as the legislature enacted some growth caps for capitation into the future that has helped us save money in the program as well. The second area we really focused on has been working more directly with provider organizations to move into areas where they are more responsible and accountable for total cost of care for the clients that we that they serve. And we the legislature in 2010 passed a provision called the healthcare demonstration healthcare demonstration delivery system demonstrations, and we issued an RFP about a year ago, and now have six organizations which serve about 100,000 of our clients who are operating in shared savings and shared gain, shared loss type of contracts, so that if they're able to we agree upon a spending trend for them. If they're able to beat that spending trend, instead of us accruing all the savings, they actually share in that savings 50-50 with us. And that's a way for them to actually work with us to try to lower the cost of care while also delivering high-quality care. This is all dependent on them meeting certain quality metrics. We do anticipate expanding that demonstration very soon, in the next month or so, hopefully to other sites around the state. So just wanted to mention those efforts that we're undertaking to try to improve the efficiency of the contracting and the delivery system that we operate under. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I have a question. On medical assistance, we are not required by the feds to offer dental care. Is that for two adults? And but we do that. Do the feds pay 50% then?
Mr. Chair, on optional benefits, so in Medicaid there are required benefits, and the feds obviously match with us on that, and the states are required to cover those benefits. On optional benefits, we can choose to cover them or not, but if we choose to cover them, the feds do share in the cost of that.
Other questions? Representative
Abrams. Oh, just a comment since we're out of time, but I wanted to, you know, Minnesota, for the new members, Minnesota has innovated consistently in some of this stuff, and even beginning with the 2007-08 Transformation Task Force, which the chair was part of, and I was around then, and so with a flipped over one party in charge and the other in the legislature. In both cases, the last six, seven years have been really remarkable. And some of the innovations just make people's heads spin. So as you get further into it, it's really fascinating. And it's nice to have agreeable reform work that when power changes, it doesn't get all undone. And another thing is, I'm just sorry we can't hear about the rocket slide again, Mr. Chair. That was a pretty good slide, the rocket. And Paige, your rocket slide?
Sideways rocket?
Yeah, that was. Sorry, I haven't got time for that.
Well, any other questions? I will say that, you know, 2007, 2008 with Governor Flint, and we operate pretty much on the health care reform and a bipartisan system. I hope we can keep doing that.
Yeah.
So with that, the meeting is adjourned.